I started this week by saying, boy, it's going to be an interesting economic week. And you know what? It sure was. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Chicago today, the studios of WBEZ, it is Friday, the 28th day of April. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you along, everybody, as it always is. Seriously, this week pretty much had it all economy-wise, right? Tax policy, trade policy, there's budget and healthcare policy wrapped up on all this as well. What does it all mean? Well, for that, we've got Neela Richardson from Redfin and Sudeep Reddy from Politico in our Washington Bureau. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Neela, I don't even know where to start. Do you want to start trade policy? Do you want to start tax? Let's start taxes, shall we? And the president's one sheet that came out. Yeah, right. President's one sheet comes out courtesy of Gary Cohn, the head of the National Economic Council, and Steve Mnuchin, the secretary of the Treasury. And it says, yeah, we're going to do some stuff. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically as detailed as it got.
Right. But that stuff seems to really help corporations. The first part of that was to lower the corporate tax rate to 15% from 35%. Then the stuff moved on to high income earners. They're also going to lower the tax rate for those people making a lot of money. Now, I say a lot of money because the plan doesn't detail who gets that benefit. So we still don't know how to score this plan, and we don't know how much revenue it will take from the federal coffers and how much it will add to the deficit. In short, we don't know how the plan will be paid for. So there's still a lot of open questions, but we do know it benefits the wealthy and corporations. And the hope is that all of that trickles back down to the economy and spurs growth.
Sudeep, she said the magic words, trickle down, discuss.
Oh, trickle down. That was by intention. Beautiful. The 80s are here again. We have seen in 100 days an extension of campaign bullet points, and that's still where we are right now. We saw the framework from the Trump campaign restated into what the administration calls broad general principles that will drive tax reform. Obviously, the whole the big plan that came out this week was triggered by the president saying a bit too early that he actually had a plan, which it was not developed. There are hundreds of people working on developing a plan, but there is no plan yet. There are the same principles we've already had. And I do think the administration is going to make a serious push to get to that point, but it's going to be tough and it's going to be ugly. And it's got a lot of businesses and investors on edge waiting for what has been promised for more than a year, that there's going to be a big jolt to the economy coming from the most complicated tax overhaul in history and the biggest tax cut in history. And we have very little evidence that they're actually any closer to it.
Yeah, all those superlatives, by the way, are according to the White House, because historians will quibble. But Neela, let me just quickly get back to your point. We don't know how this is going to be paid for. And more to the point, we don't know what Congress is going to do to this plan, because they've got their own ideas. Paul Ryan and Kevin Brady on House Ways and Means, they have their own thoughts on this.
They do. And what's really important, that is, if this plan adds to the deficit over the next 10 years, they not only need Republican support to pass it, they need Democrats to pass it. Oh, no, because that means that it has to benefit both the wealthy, the corporations, and the middle class. Everybody has to win. It has to be a win, 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 win. And that is very hard to achieve with tax policy.
Can we talk for a second, Sudeep, about trade policy and the fact that within, I think it was 3 hours at one point on Wednesday, we were out of NAFTA or going out of NAFTA, and then all of a sudden we were back in?
It is a flexible policy and a flexible administration. That's the generous way of putting it. We are still in the early stages of the Trump team really figuring out where it's going to land on any of these fronts. We know that the administration decided very early on that they were going to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've known all along that NAFTA was going to at least be renegotiated, and that's where we appear to be headed right now. We don't know what that will look like. It could be a repackaging of what NAFTA already is, and the president could declare, I just cut a better deal, and nobody can really dispute that it was renegotiated if you change some of the principles. These trade deals need to change after a few decades. Everybody agrees with that. But what we were heading toward was a messaging disaster to be able to state broadly that you're going to pull out of a trade deal and watch businesses and financial markets respond to not much more than bullet points again.
Words have meaning. Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Neela Richardson from Redfin. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, it was a strong start, long, slow slide into the finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the things we didn't get to up top was the completely lackluster report on gross domestic product that came out this morning. Just 0.7% growth on an annualized basis, that is, January through March. It's the lowest rate in 3 years, and more to the point, is the latest in a long line of simply lousy first quarters. Interestingly enough, though, we know why that happens. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the story.
GDP is the total of all goods and services the economy produces, and it's already seasonally adjusted to take out the big ups and downs that happen predictably every winter or spring, but that don't reflect any real underlying change in the economy. For instance, says economist Betsy Stevenson at the University of Michigan, take the seasonal retail hiring boom.
Imagine if the jobs report told you how many people were hired in December and then how many people lost their jobs in January but didn't adjust for the big decrease that comes in the post-holiday.
Economic reports smooth that over so it doesn't look like the economy just went boom and then bust. Except, says Nariman Baravesh at IHS Market, studies show that for GDP reports over the past 30 years,
the first quarter is almost always low. And the second quarter is almost always high. And this is because the Commerce Department hasn't quite gotten that seasonal adjustment right.
Economists call this problem residual seasonality, a failure to adjust for all the predictable dips and surges. For instance, this appears to be skewing defense and consumer spending. Now, this is not the same as extreme weather affecting the economy, says Stevenson. We don't want to adjust the data for an unexpectedly warm January because
people didn't have to spend as much money on home heating oil. Does that mean they're going to take better vacations this summer? Maybe.
But she says if extreme weather events become more common with a changing climate, they should be included in seasonal adjustment. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've done a couple of stories the past 3 months about the regulatory relief being provided by the Trump administration and whether that's enough to overcome some of the market forces that are happening out there. Coal, for one example. Today, oil. Today, the president signed an executive order expanding offshore oil and gas drilling in the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans. The theory from the White House is that that's going to create jobs. But with a barrel of crude at $50, give or take, and having been stuck there for a while, well, market forces seem to win this round. But if companies aren't going to go to the Arctic, then where are they going to go? Marketplace's Adam Allington has that.
Offshore drilling is expensive, especially to open up new areas. It requires extensive geological studies and testing, and it's just out there in the water, hard to get to. But you know what isn't hard to get to? The Permian Basin in West Texas.
The Permian is one of the hottest hotspots in the whole world, and that's kind of interesting that there's so much oil and gas to be had in a place that really is convenient.
Convenient, says Michael Weber of the University of Texas, because the Permian is close to refineries and in a region, Texas, duh, where people know a thing or two about oil and gas. Plus, Weber says new hydraulic fracking techniques have answered an age-old question for the oil industry.
Where do you go to find oil when you run out in one place? And the answer is the same place, but drill deeper and try a little harder.
Up until recently, if oil was trading at $50 or so like it is now, that was the break-even point. Not much incentive to drill. Tom Kloza is head of energy analysis for Oil Price Information Service. He says innovations in fracking have made existing wells more efficient, and the break-even has gone down.
In many cases, the costs are coming down to $35 or so.
Which makes it worth it, Kloza says, to stay put in Texas while prices remain flat.
The chapter of cheap oil certainly continues for the rest of this decade and probably, you know, maybe in the early part of the next.
That's why the near-term future is all about onshore. His company predicts that the Permian will soon produce more oil per year than Iran or Iraq. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Amazon CEO and founder Jeff Bezos got $5 billion richer this morning in about an hour. Amazon reported profits at the open today and the company had some, hence the bump in share price and Bezos's fortunes. Most of the company's earnings came not from selling books, electronics, and whatnot all over the planet, but from its cloud computing division, Amazon Web Services. And while Amazon did lead the way, others have followed, Microsoft and Google up into the cloud in particular. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Alphabet CFO Ruth Porat put it plainly in yesterday's first quarter earnings call.
Cloud is one of our most important strategic priorities.
In the digital economy, companies need increasingly sophisticated IT infrastructure, and independent analyst Joe McKendrick says it's easier and cheaper to let somebody else do the work.
It's just too difficult to run your own data center these days. That's why cloud computing is so appealing. Someone else runs all that stuff, and you can worry about your business.
Google and Microsoft were late to the game. It's been more than a decade since Amazon started renting out its excess computing infrastructure during the retail off-season. Today, it owns about 40% of the market, according to Synergy Research Group, with Microsoft, IBM, and Google sharing just 23%. David Linthicum helps businesses migrate to the cloud as Senior Vice President of Cloud Technology Partners.
Amazon is so far ahead in terms of revenue and just momentum in the market, it's going to be very difficult to catch up.
Linthicum estimates the market will be worth $30 billion by the end of this year, with lots of room to grow. Morningstar analyst Rodney Nelson says most big companies still only use the cloud for a small portion of their IT needs.
But over time, we expect to see the overwhelming majority of workloads and data move into a public cloud environment.
And analysts say the race to provide that environment will only get tighter. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The standard line about the American military, you know, right? Be it uttered by politicians, celebrities, or spotted on bumper stickers. Support our troops. But hundreds of the actual people who do that day in and day out, helping service members and veterans and their families in what are called family assistance centers, just took a huge pay cut. Catherine Rampell is a columnist for the Washington Post and a regular here on Fridays. As you know, she wrote about this story earlier this week in the paper. Catherine, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here.
Tell me about these family assistance centers. What do they do?
Essentially, they provide services or they connect soldiers, airmen, veterans, military families with various kinds of services, legal, financial, or otherwise. So if they find out that a veteran is homeless, they try to find housing. And they do lots of other things, too. You know, if a service member is deployed and needs someone to take care of his or her dog, they find someone to take care of the dog. They basically do the literal work of supporting our troops.
And now for, I guess, the third time in the last three, four-ish years, the contract between the National Guard Bureau and these centers has been adjusted, and the workers are paying the price, quite literally.
Yes. So there were two different contracts for similar kinds of workers, not actually for the family assistance centers, mm-hmm. but other kinds of government contract workers who do various kinds of services to help military families. In each of these three recent contracts, the new company won the bid by changing the classification of these workers to something that was lower paid. And in the case of the family assistance centers, that's what happened as well. So around the country, you are seeing this contract has been taken over, people's wages have been slashed, and everyone's quitting.
How many people have left? How many jobs? I mean, do we know the scale of what's going on here?
Yes, we have a sense of it. So there are about 400 people who were affected by these pay cuts. And when I asked the National Guard earlier this week how many vacancies there were, they said there were about 90. And, of course, that does not count people who accepted the work but are actively looking for other jobs. You know, basically they're just trying to get this to tide them over but are actively sending out resumes too.
How much of a pay cut are we talking about here?
On average, it's about a third. In some cases, people lost about half of their hourly pay. Depends on where they live and what their job title is. But in some cases, people are earning basically burger flipping wages. You know, they're earning $10 an hour here.
What happens now?
The head of the National Guard testified earlier this week in a Senate hearing and was asked about this, and he said that they were looking into it. Beyond that, I'm not sure. As I mentioned, there is a suggestion that these workers may be misclassified and actually an outside organization, Good Jobs Nation, they advocate basically on behalf of government contract workers. They have filed a complaint with the Labor Department asking the Labor Department to investigate and look into whether these people are misclassified. If indeed they were, they would be owed back pay, of course, and potentially get a raise.
And then, in theory, people would come and do this job again of actually supporting the troops.
Yes, one would hope. As I said, these are very critical jobs, and you want those jobs to be well compensated as a result because you want good people in them doing this important work.
Catherine Rempel is a Friday regular with us. More to the point, though, she's a columnist at The Washington Post, writing earlier this week about services and support for the troops. Catherine, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up.
No, government don't care about none of us.
Another visit to Erie, PA, where optimism, well, it's not for everybody. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 40 points today, about a 10%, closed at 20,940. The NASDAQ down a point, about flat, finished at 6,047. The S&P 500 off 4 points, a 10%, 2384. For the 5 days gone by, Dow up 1.9%, the NASDAQ up 2.3%, the S&P 500 added 1.5%, a percent and a half is another way to say that. Talked about oil a little bit. Here you go. ExxonMobil up 0.4%, beat quarterly earnings expectations. So did Chevron, boosted about 1.1%. Royal Dutch Shell sputtered, though, down about 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And we want to know what you want to know
about business, technology, and culture.
Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And check us out wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We rolled out the latest Marketplace Edison Research poll this week. And among the many, many things we asked was what people thought would happen economically were we to build the wall. 57% of Americans think building a wall on our southern border would hurt the economy. Of the millions of undocumented immigrants already in this country, more than 100,000 are estimated to live in Austin, Texas. Law enforcement down there has promised not to arrest or detain people just because they are undocumented. But that promise is running up against a bill about to become law in Texas, as well as very firm requests from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And it's all costing Austin money. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
Down at the Travis County Civil Courthouse in downtown Austin, five or six bailiffs stand next to a metal detector talking about their weekend plans. One asks me what I'm up to when I put my recording gear on the security belt. I tell him I'm reporting on Austin's sanctuary city status. He tells me I need to go next door to the criminal court. Armed Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents entered the courthouse several weeks ago and rounded up undocumented immigrants, according to Travis County Judge Sarah Eckhart. She calls it a raid that undermined her work.
This, I would submit, is not about sanctuary cities. I would submit that this is straight-up political retribution.
A U.S. judge found that the raid was retaliation for the county refusing to cooperate, though ICE characterized the operation as routine. There's been financial retaliation, too. Texas Governor Greg Abbott cut $1.5 million from Travis County's budget. Eckhart says that will mean cuts to social services, a punishment from the state that doesn't fit the supposed crime.
They are court programs. They are parks programs. They are emergency and disaster programs. Not a one of them has anything to do with immigration.
She estimates 4,600 people will lose services, many of them undocumented immigrants. Austin Mayor Steve Adler says when ICE raided the court, it also hit other locations. That's ruined trust between the immigrant community and local law enforcement and undercut Austin's outreach efforts to immigrants.
We find that the social service that we're providing to families and children are not having their clients show up in increasing numbers.
Mayor Adler went to D.C. to meet with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. He wants clarity on what sanctuary city means in the eyes of the feds. Lots of other mayors do, too. And it's not just government or law enforcement having trouble reaching immigrants due to all the confusion and fear. Justin Estep runs the Immigration Law Clinic at Catholic Charities of Central Texas.
Even when we try to put on informational clinics, one of the first questions we get is, how do we know that, since y'all are advertising this, that ICE isn't just going to park outside of the event and, you know, collect documents as people exit?
Schools, hospitals, and churches are what ICE calls sensitive locations. That means agents aren't supposed to arrest people there, but it's not a hard and fast rule. Courthouses are not on that list. In a statement to Marketplace, ICE said the agency does arrest targets at courthouses, but only after investigating officers have exhausted other options. Travis County Judge Eckhart says if local police have to detain anyone who can't prove they're here legally, she's going to have a space problem.
We can manage a population of about 2,700 people in our Travis County jail. We are right up at our population limit currently. If we are conscripted as an ICE detention facility, that means we are holding individuals for the federal government instead of holding individuals that we feel are a public safety threat.
And if Travis County doesn't agree to hold those people, it could be breaking federal law. That could mean losing $52 million in federal grants for parks, highways, all kinds of things. She's part of a team drafting a new county budget in case that happens.
What we're looking at is either you cut services because you no longer have this grant revenue source, or you replace the grant revenue source either with borrowed one-time funds or with a tax increase.
It's looking like Austin and Travis County will have to move some money around. This week, the Texas legislature passed a bill that makes sanctuary city practices illegal. It also calls for any sheriffs or police chiefs who don't comply with ICE to be fired, like Travis County Sheriff Sally Hernandez. Judge Eckhart says Travis County will continue to contest it. The fight over federal funding for sanctuary cities is tied up in court. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We've been doing this series on the program since Inauguration Day. It's called The Big Promise, based out of Erie, Pennsylvania. It's a look at how President Trump's policies and the promises he made are playing in a town where the economy is changing. I was in Erie yesterday, and we took a swing by a bait shop. It's called Presque Isle Angler Bait and Tackle.
Hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Good, thanks. I'm Kai.
It's kind of place where you can get your supplies. A couple of worms, some tackle, a cup of coffee, too. Laura Daniels runs the business with her husband, Andy. She says she's got plenty of regulars.
You have everything from people who own these beautiful yachts, but they fish too and they come in. And then you have the poor guy that really does come down every day picking change out of his pocket to buy bait to go catch his dinner.
But it's also a place for folks to just listen too.
What's the most important thing for you in this economy right now?
In this area, it's a little troublesome because obviously we're an industrial town that is on its last leg of the great days of industry.
GE Transportation used to be the biggest employer around town. The company cut a third of its remaining workforce the past couple of years, a workforce, I should say, already well down from its peak. And manufacturing hasn't just been from GE either. Hammermill Paper, American Meter, Steris have also up and gone. That whole thing has changed Erie from the kind of place this guy knew.
Patrick Fioravanti.
Grow up in Erie?
Yes.
How old are you?
60.
You're working or you're retired?
Retired.
From what?
General Electric.
What'd you do?
I worked at the water treatment plant.
For how many years?
42 years.
Started when you were 18 at GE?
17.
17.
Left at 60. Was employed for 42 years, 3 months, and 20 days.
Do you think government cares about you anymore?
No, government don't care about none of us.
Why do you believe that?
Just from what I see. They say they do, but it's every man for himself.
That's the same thing we heard in the last round of polling we did with Edison Research. Nearly 3/4 of the people in this country feel Washington has just forgotten about them. And here in this bait shop, a reminder of what that can feel like in the day-to-day. From a guy named Mike Torak.
So what's the most important thing for you in this economy?
Providing for my children and that, mostly.
So when the political conversation turns to health care and tax reform?
Yeah, I don't like to get involved in all that stuff. I hate politics. I don't listen to it, don't watch it. I don't like those headaches.
More stories from Erie, Pennsylvania as our series The Big Promise continues next week. You can check out all the rest of the coverage online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which, in case you hadn't heard, is one day shy of the 100th day of the Trump presidency. So here with, courtesy of the good people in the data shop at Twitter, the top words the president of the United States has used in the past 99 days on his favorite semi-official policymaking platform. Number one was great. Number two, America or American. Number three, media or news. There you go. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow off about 40 today. The NASDAQ basically flat. S&P 500 down 4 points. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. The show is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend, all right? Oh, and yeah, this is APM.